Rewiring Your Life with Erica Spiegelman and Marcia Stone. Wellness, inspiration, support.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Rewiring Your Life podcast. My name is Marcia Stone, and I co-host this podcast weekly with my good friend, Erica Spiegelman. We developed this podcast in order to provide tips, tools, and conversations on wellness, inspiration, and support. We have extraordinary guests who are changing the world through their expertise, and they know what it's like to lead their best lives and inspire all of us to do the same. We are so fortunate today to have amazing guests joining us, Dr. Mark Pimentel. And Dr. Pimentel has been recognized as an expert and is an author. He wrote the book, The Microbiome Connection. He is a professor of medicine and gastroenterology at Geffen School of Medicine in UCLA and associate professor of medicine at Cedars-Sinai, Los Angeles. He's also the head of the Pimentel Laboratory and the executive director of the Medically Associated Science and Technology Program at Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles. Dr. Pimentel has decades of experience, and he was a pioneer in gastroenterological research that led him to develop the LFE diet to help people who suffer from SIBO enjoy a less restrictive diet and lifestyle. He's a pioneering expert in irritable bowel syndrome and has been widely published in several different journals of medicine. Welcome, Dr. Pimentel, and thank you so much for being here today.
It's so good to talk to you. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. There was a lot more to your biography, but I felt like we should go ahead and start with the interview so that I wouldn't take up our whole time reading about all of your amazing accomplishments. But I have to say, I was really impressed when I was reading about you and just everything that you've pioneered and researched and written about. So I just wanted to ask you from the very beginning, how did you become interested in this field and specifically helping patients that suffer from irritable bowel syndrome, IBS, as we call it?
Yeah, well, I've been at Cedars for now 26 years. And in the beginning of that whole journey, IBS wasn't something I was necessarily interested in. But what I learned very quickly is that these patients were characterized in the 1990s as it's a psychological problem. We don't understand it, therefore it's stress. And this is a common thing that happens in medicine. When doctors don't understand a condition, they call it stress-related. And that's where it was at the time. And yet, in my clinics, I was seeing patient after patient after patient with IBS, and they were like the person next door. They were suffering, and they were fed up with being told it's in their head, and they were suffering with a lot of bloating and symptoms. And that got me very intrigued about what the cause of IBS was.
Right. And that makes sense, because I can imagine it might have been frustrating for you, as it was for your patients, that you were seeing that they knew something was going on, and maybe they felt like they were being dismissed in some way.
Completely. I mean, and when we started to get into the microbiome of IBS, which we'll get to, it was remarkable how much better they would get. How can they get better if stress is the cause? And who's not stressed?
Right, right. I'm certainly stressed, and I'm sure you are. We have a rat race. We have a schedule. We have things to do. We're constantly, you know, available because we all have cell phones now. So I agree with you about the stress, but I did want to ask you two things. Number one, obviously I'm not an expert on irritable bowel syndrome, but I am an expert at talking to people. And I have really observed maybe over the last 20, 30 years that I hear more about IBS. Is that true? Or is there more, are there more people suffering because of, you know, our genetically modified diets, et cetera? Or is it just that people feel like they're able to talk about it more because it's become, you know, a recognized condition, I guess?
Well, this is where I hope that our work has made some contribution to this, as among others, because a lot of people are starting to do work in this area. But irritable bowel syndrome, again, it was thought of as stress, psychology, or, you know, and doctors used to tell their patients, you need to see a psychologist or a psychiatrist. I mean, if I didn't think I had a psychiatric problem or psychological problem, I would hide it, because I don't want to tell people I have IBS. But I think what we understand now is that IBS is a real disease. And as a result, people are more frank about it, more open about it. And it's been good. It's been patients are coming out of the woodwork. There are treatments now.
That's so good. That's so hopeful. I have a good friend who suffers from Crohn's. And I was just curious, Is Crohn's sort of like IBS? I guess I should ask you a bigger question. How is it identified? What are the symptoms that are equal a diagnosis?
Yeah, well, irritable bowel syndrome, first of all, affects about 10 to 15% of the human population. So it's not an uncommon condition. And it's characterized by abdominal discomfort, changes in your bowel pattern, so either diarrhea, constipation, or both, sort of mixing it up, and then bloating. And what's sort of unique, sort of pointing to your question about Crohn's disease, is that Crohn's disease is bad. You have diarrhea. You have diarrhea every day. You may have it five times a day for a month, and then you might go into remission and sort of waxes and wanes over months. IBS is very different. It's unpredictable. You could have no diarrhea today, and then tomorrow, in the middle of a meeting with your boss in a conference room, you have the bagel and you have to run to the bathroom and you're gone for half an hour. It just hits you. And so it's that unpredictable nature of IBS really affects quality of life. Look, no one wants Crohn's or five bowel movements a day, but if you have five every day, you sort of know what's going to happen. IBS patients never know, and so it's hard to socialize, go on dates, do things, go to a movie theater, fly on airplanes, because you end up in the bathroom for half an hour and somebody's knocking on the door in an airplane. You can imagine what that feels like for the
patient. You're embarrassed.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's something that's embarrassing for people and hard to plan around. I didn't even really think about that component until you said that, but it's almost like you're a hostage to some extent.
Exactly.
By your own body. Well, what causes it? Is it genetic? You know, what do we know what causes it? And, you know, what? How do you come to that conclusion? It is officially IBS and it's not just, you know, you're allergic to gluten or whatever.
Well, there's a number of things that can be done. Obviously, IBS, because it's categorically nothing, meaning you've looked for everything else, you can't find anything. For a while, it was just a sort of a smattering of conditions, possibly. But we've come down a long way. We now know that 60% or maybe even more of the diarrhea mixed form of IBS is actually started by food poisoning. So you went on a vacation somewhere, you got E. coli or salmonella or something like that, or you ate some bad food. And then ever since then, you've had IBS, and we actually developed the first blood test to say that's how it happened, and you have IBS, and you have a real disease, and that's found in about 56% of IBSD patients, and that test is measuring antibody to a toxin from that original food poisoning, and an antibody that you developed to the nerves of your gut because of that toxin that you got exposed to. So we can actually diagnose IBS for the first time in 2022, and patients can get that answer, and IBS is real for them. And that's amazing.
Wow. That's a relief. They must feel relieved to some extent just to know and, you know, have something to point to. This is what this is. I'm not walking around thinking, you know, Googling all the things that we do when we don't know what's wrong.
Yeah. And if people want to know, the test is IBS Smart. I am part of the company because we did develop it, but just so that they know that this is out there and they can, you know, their doctor can make a decision about whether to do it or not. But it gives them peace of mind that they now know how it all started for them.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I was doing some reading the other day. I was in the behavioral health field for a long time, and I'm considering participating in a new program that's coming out in Austin where there's a lot of focus on gut health. Mostly the sort of the focus of this group would be how it affects your mood, depression, if you're likely to, you know, abuse alcohol or drugs or something like that, that there's all kinds of research going on now that really, you know, connects the dots from gut health, digestion, all those things to the way that you kind of see the world, experience the world, show up every day for your family or for your job and everything. Have you noticed that also in your field with, you know, the nerves in the gut? And then do you feel that, you know, sort of part and parcel to that, digestive problems are more prominent now than they used to be? I'm curious.
Well, I think we're recognizing digestive problems more commonly now, and we're actually acknowledging them rather than saying, look, you're not going to die from this. Go home and, you know, just change, you know, your lifestyle. Go do some yoga. And I'm not being facetious. These are things patients have been told. But in terms of the nerve question,
or take Xanax or something like that, probably.
Yes, and that happens, and people have been giving antidepressants and other things for IBS. I had a very early story in my career where, you know, we treated the woman with an antibiotic because what happens in this whole story is that there's a buildup of bacteria in the gut in IBS, and we gave her the correct antibiotic. Her IBS completely went away, and she brought me a brown paper bag with all the stuff from the Xanaxes to the antidepressants to, it was a bag of about 10 different pill bottles. And she said, I don't have to take this ever again. And these are the things that people had tried over the years. But, you know, I see all the time patients are anxious. I have another woman who, you know, she wouldn't go to the grocery store. She literally wouldn't because she was afraid, because so many times she'd end up in line and then have to run to the bathroom in the grocery store, and sometimes she didn't make it because it was so urgent. And so she became very anxious about that. Now she can, but, you know, so these stories are real, and I'm sure some of your listeners will resonate with these stories.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think it's just so important that we have these conversations. You know, and I guess it's, I have five children, four boys, and no offense to you, you're a man, but boys love potty humor. And so, you know, it's been something that I've sort of experienced my whole life raising kids. And, you know, it really goes into what you're saying now, because it's something that we're all kind of embarrassed about. We're all, you know, we kind of laugh and giggle and, you know, and try to push it aside. But to be able to really openly talk about something that affects every single one of us in some way, I mean, huge congratulations and thank you. I will say thank you for really honing in on this, because I have no doubt that you've helped hundreds of thousands of people probably.
Well, I'm just happy to be blessed to have some ideas that may be beneficial to the population, and hopefully they are benefited, as you said.
Yeah. When you first started, you know, researching this and thinking about a different way to look at it, were you met with, you know, sort of pushback from your esteemed peers in the medical fraternity?
Oh, for sure. I mean, we're talking about a field that was mostly driven by psychiatry, where IBS was really in the psychiatric realm. And I converted it to the microbiology realm, which is, you know, going from right field to left field. There are a lot of resistance. It wasn't really until 15 years of work and research and accumulation of information that it started to turn. And of course, now it's well recognized as a microbiome condition. But those early days were very, very difficult. And you almost want to give up. But you know, you see the patients, you can't. If you believe in something and it's true, then you have to keep persisting.
Oh, I'm so glad that you did. And I do want to talk about your new book, The Microbiome Connection. So maybe you can tell us about that. But I'm also curious about this low fermentation eating plan. I don't know if you can tie both of those subjects together before we run out of time here. But I'm really interested about the specific eating plan, and also about your new book that's coming out. Like, who can benefit from reading that book? I'm excited to hear.
Well, the way I like to write a book, if it's going to be sold like this, is, and the book is The Microbiome Connection, is I want it to be easy enough to read for everybody to read, but also with containing enough good information that physicians can educate themselves as well. And so that's how we've written it. And it's basically going through the story of how food poisoning caused IBS, how that caused the change in the gut bacteria so that they're building up in the small intestine, and the treatments that are available medically. But it then goes into, okay, so now you've got this problem with your gut, its function is poor, and it tends to want to build up bacteria. Well, what do the bacteria love to eat? What can we do in our diets that would make it less likely for the bacteria to come back? But as we've talked about through and through in this interview, I'm all about the patient living normally. Because you can eat nothing and the bacteria will go away. But that's not living. I want people to be able to go to a restaurant and not have to, you know, get too creative, that they can find anything on any restaurant menu. And because, you know, the other thing that's embarrassing to patients is they go to a restaurant and they have to ask the waiter 20 questions while their other friends are just saying, I'll have that. and make it lifestyle appropriate. And that's what low fermentation eating is. It gives you a very sort of strict guideline on things you really should avoid and some more leniency on things that are sort of middle of the road that you could get away with occasionally. And to try and keep the bacteria less fed, but you fed. And that's the whole purpose of low fermentation eating. It's both an eating guide and a lifestyle. The other thing that low fermentation eating talks about is spacing between meals, because your gut is an amazing thing. What it does is it cleans itself between eating. So if you're noshing or nibbling all day, you never give your gut a break. Your gut is designed to have breaks or fasting periods so that it can clean itself up and be ready for the next meal. And if you don't clean up, the bacteria are also eating all day. So it's a combination of the types of foods and the style with which you eat that makes it all come together.
Can you just give me a couple of examples? You know, what are the types of foods that these bacteria prefer or like to eat, as you said?
Well, number one is sugar. And what we've been doing for the last 10 years is trying to convert almost all food products that are sweet with artificial sweeteners. And initially, it was the saccharin and the NutraSweet. And NutraSweet is a protein. No problem. Bacteria don't really care for proteins as much as sugar. So NutraSweet was okay. But now we have sucralose, which is a sugar. Maltitol, xylitol, sorbitol, all sugars that we humans don't absorb, but the bacteria love it. So we're feeding the bacteria all of this. And then fiber, which, you know, fiber is sort of a double-edged sword. People say, oh, you have to have a lot of fiber. But to be honest, fiber feeds the bacteria of the gut because it's a sugar that's in long chains that we can't digest. So anything that's a sugar that humans can't absorb, 100% goes to the bacteria. And so we suggest that you, at a first pass, avoid all of those sorts of things.
Yeah. I mean, I've talked to and read so much about the amount of sugar that's in our daily American diet these days versus what it was even, you know, 30, 40 years ago. And it seems like we've all, in some ways, you know, just become so accustomed to eating so much sugar that obviously it's bad for us. It's, you know, weight issues and diabetes and all the other things. And now that you've talked to us today about it just sort of seems like it just, you know, continues to feed the problem in a way.
Well, you know, it's doctors are also a problem, right? Because we told everybody eat less fat, so now we're eating more sugar. Now we're more obese than we used to be.
Right.
Not everything we recommend works out 20 years from now when we look back at it. And so we just have, it's always like your mom said. Your mom said a little bit of everything and too much of one thing is a bad thing. And I think that's true today, is that, you know, you have to have fat in your food, not zero fat, because you got to replace it with something else and that'll be bad for you. So that's, your mom was always right. My mom was anyways.
Well, I'm telling you, I mean, when I think back on it, yes, everything that we ever needed to know. Well, that is so enlightening. And I just, you know, again, I'm so grateful for your work and, you know, I'm really grateful. And I think my listeners would agree that your perseverance is to be commended as well, because I'm sure, as we talked about, it wasn't always easy. And now, you know, coming to the other side in some ways and being able to continue to help people, that must be very rewarding for you. So thank you so much for all of your hard work.
That's my pleasure. It's good to see people getting better. So that's the reward.
Well, every time we have our podcast at the end, we always ask what we call the deep dive question. Are you open to that today?
Sure.
Doctor, what is your superpower?
Oh, my God. My superpower is, if you looked behind me, there's a whole team of people working on this topic. Mm. They are my superpower. They are dedicated scientists who took a chance on this idea with us and went on a journey.
Oh, I love that answer. You know, I've never heard that answer. And that, you know, that answer is wonderful. And it also speaks to your humility. And that is a wonderful characteristic for someone to have. So thank you again for being with us and enlightening us. I'm sure that the readers have learned so much today, as have I. And just to remind everyone to go check out Dr. Pimentel's new work, and where can they find you on the on social media, et cetera? If someone wanted to look up your work, where could they find you?
I post on Twitter quite a bit, at Mark Pimentel MD. That's one place. Or they can come to the Cedars-Sinai Mass Program website. We post a lot of our up-to-date research and ideas there.
Fantastic. Thank you again, and to all the listeners out there today. Thank you for being with us, and until next week, be well.